Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is George Werthner. He's the Ecological Projects Director for the Foundation for Deep Ecology. He's an ecologist and wildlands activist. He's published 37 books on environmental issues and natural history, including such environmentally focused books as Welfare Ranching, Wildfire, Thrillcraft, Energy, and most recently, Keeping the Wild. So thank you so much for being on the program, and thank you for your work.
A pleasure to be here, Derek. Thanks for inviting me.
So I guess what I want to talk about today is predators. So can we talk, I would like to talk about the importance of predators in the real world, and also this culture's really messed up relationship with predators. It seems to have very much of a hate relationship with predators.
Well, you're exactly right. I think that predator management, if you want to call it that, which usually means killing them, is sort of a example of the mindset that comes with the concept that humans should be dominating and controlling the planet, which is part of this larger, what some people call the neo-green movement or whatever, which within the context of that, the idea is that we are now affecting the planet in so many ways. There's no such thing as wild places or wild animals left anymore, in truth, that everything is subject to human control and manipulation. And not only is that happening, but that it's a good thing and that we ought to, you know, sort of pony up and take our place as captains of the universe. And I think that mindset is exemplified by our attitudes towards predators. And I'll give you some background first on predators and why they're important and why we probably have that attitude, and then give some examples, I think, of how that attitude is causing a lot of problems with predators that are unnecessary. And the first thing I'll specifically talk about predators in North America, because I'm not really familiar with things like lions and tigers to any great degree. But most of what I say will apply to predators around the world. In North America, the prime larger predators, and that's what I'm going to focus on, are wolves, cougars or mountain lions, as they're called, and then the black bears, grizzly bears and coyotes. And those predators have a very important ecological function in ecosystems. They, if you want to have a value judgment about them, you can say that the benefits of predators is that they filter out weaker animals that are either not maladapted for the particular landscape, and they can keep numbers of their prey from getting so large as to cause problems. For example, in some places, high numbers of elk or moose, for example, which are a common prey of wolves, can damage plants by excessive browsing. And predators also shift the habitat use of some of those animals. So, for example, elk might have a tendency to hang out in lower country near streams when there's no predators present, but will be more widely dispersed when there are predators like wolves. And the interesting thing about how there's ripple effects all the way through the ecosystem, and I'll give you a number of examples of that. For example, dispersing elk away from streams and more widely distributed on the landscape in a place like Yellowstone or other places where there are bears means that those animals are more likely to die, whether from predators and or, you know, accident, starvation, or whether away from valley bottoms where most of the roads are. So if you're a grizzly bear and you find an elk that's died, if it dies next to a road, you're not likely to feed on it because most bears and a lot of other animals like that shy away from human contact. But if it dies a mile or two away from a road, it's more likely to be a benefit to that bear. And that's one result of having the predators sort of disperse prey animals like elk around. Another way that they can influence the landscape and how things work, there are all sorts of effects, ripple effects, you might say, of having predators in the landscape. Like, you know, one of the things you would never expect, but wolves, for example, because they can keep elk away from riparian areas, means that, and the riparian areas are those places along creeks, means that the creek beds and stream-sized vegetation is in better shape. Better shaped stream-sized vegetation helps to hold streams banks together and creates habitat for insects, which increases the food for trout and other fish. So most people would never see the connection of having wolves back on the landscape and more trout in a stream, which in turn would be more food for fish-eating birds like osprey or eagles or other fish-eating mammals like mink and otter. And another example of that same sort of thing, because of the tendency of wolves to either chase away or even kill coyotes, you can have more rodents around, coyotes like to feed on small rodents, more rodents around the perimeter and in vicinity of wolf dens because of the concentration of wolves and the lack of coyotes there, which in turn creates more food for hawks and other birds of prey that feed on small rodents. Another example is coyotes will feed on, and one of the major predators on pronghorn antelope fawn. And again, if you have wolves in the, present in the area, you reduce the predation by coyotes on antelope fawn. So these ripple effects, and many others that we're probably not aware of, but these are some of the ones that have been found and documented, ripple through the whole ecosystem. And when we eliminate the top predators like that, then we have problems. For example, in the eastern United States, the high numbers of white-tailed deer, due to partially a lack of predators, as well as management policies by fish and game departments trying to maximize the number of white-tailed deer, have reduced the regeneration of some forest tree species because they are eaten by the deer. And also because of high deer numbers can reduce the small shrubs and flowers on the forest floor, it reduces hiding cover for ground nesting birds, which have declined in some eastern forests. So these are many examples of why having predators on the landscape will keep ecological processes and ecosystems healthier, so to speak, or functioning more properly. And but at the same time, of course, particularly the larger predators are seen as competitors with humans. So hunters, in particular, are very much often express negative views about wolves and mountain lions and so forth. You know, a lot of them will say, you know, I'm not against all wolves and mountain lions present, just that there aren't too many of them. But the problem with that is if you don't have too many of them, you don't get the ecological processes. In other words, if you just have some token wolves or some token mountain lions, they won't have that top-down effect on the other species and will not have the ecological benefits that result. And the same thing, and the other major group that generally doesn't like predators are ranchers and farmers, because their livestock is vulnerable to predators as well. But one of the things that we find or are finding is that, and this is sort of pretty new information, is that by trying to kill predators, whether it's coyotes, whether it's wolves, whether it's cougars or bears, we disrupt the social relationships of those animals. And you know, these animals are just not a cog in a gear. They have interrelationships between each other as well as other species. So, for example, when you have you kill mountain lions, a lot of hunters try to kill the largest male mountain lions when they hunt. And male mountain lions usually have a territory that overlaps four or five female mountain lions. And what they do is they tend to keep younger males out of that territory. And they will even kill a young male if they have the opportunity. And that territory then, where that male is the dominant male, has a lot fewer, first of all, has fewer mountain lions in it. And it has, you don't get to be a dominant male mountain lion by being stupid, by being bold, and by being careless about how you are around humans. And so when the hunter takes out that dominant male mountain lion, it upsets the apple cart, so to speak. Now you have no individual mountain lion patrolling that territory, and you may get two, three, four young mountain lions rushing into that territory trying to occupy it. Now, the problem is young mountain lions are not very skillful at capturing prey. They don't know the territory either. They may not know where the deer hang out or the elk hang out or the calving grounds of elk herd and so forth. And as a result, they're going to be less efficient at providing their own food, particularly wild food. And if there's any domestic livestock around, they're going to be more inclined to go after the domestic livestock, because they're not as skillful hunters, because they're like teenage boys, bolder, less careful, and also more desperate. And so they've done a few places where they've done studies and shown that as the population of mountain lions declines, the number of complaints about predation and just other encounters, in other words, mountain lions wandering through somebody's backyard or something, is increased. And that has a lot to do with the destabilization of the social system. And in a similar way, it also affects females, because, for example, you can't usually tell whether you've got a male or female mountain lion just, you know, quickly. So if you see a mountain lion cross the road and you just shoot at it, you're more likely to probably kill a female than a male, because they're a little more numerous. And the females are also can have young anytime during the year. So you don't know that you haven't killed a mother with cubs that are still not fully able to feed themselves. And again, you set up a situation then where you have a lot of young mountain lions wandering around who are not skillful, who aren't good hunters, who are bold and desperate. And again, you've set up the conflicts. Now, the same thing applies to other predators. I'll use an example with wolves. Most fish and game departments manage for populations. What I mean by that is they say, we want 20 wolves in this particular area. I'm just going to use that number. And we're going to, if there's 30 wolves, we're going to try to shoot or otherwise trap them or reduce them till we get 20. And 20 is fine, because that means they're not going to go extinct in that area. So we're going to have 20 wolves. But they don't pay attention to what the population structure is of those 20 wolves. And you can have 20 wolves in one pack, or you can have 20 wolves in, multiple packs. But the difference in the age structure and the population structure can be very different, and the outcome of how those animals behave is different then. So, for example, if you had four wolf packs each with five animals in it. That's 20 wolves. But with four wolf packs, you would likely have two adult wolves, and we'll say each of those four packs has three pups. So you've got 12 pups. You've got the four packs with the two adults. Or you can have a pack of 20, which is much more likely to have far more adults. We'll just, for argument's sake, say there's 15 adults and only five pups. The larger pack is going to be able to, one, hold onto a territory easier because it can dominate other wolves. It's also going to be able to, if it kills an elk or a deer, guard that carcass and more completely consume it than if you're just a small pack and, you know, you're out, you kill an elk and you got to bring the meat back to the den where the other adult is. By the time you get back, ravens, coyotes, and so forth may have well consumed it. So as a result, the smaller packs are more likely actually to kill more elk and deer, and they are also more likely to attack livestock because of the same reasons like I talked about with mountain lions, in that they are likely to be younger, less experienced, and have less knowledge of their particular terrain. So what all this says is that predator control and hunting and trapping, which agencies, whether it's fish and game agencies or the federal government's animal damage control unit that go out and kill predators, are always saying they're doing it to reduce conflicts with humans. But because they ignore these social relationships among predators, there's good evidence to suggest that they are actually creating more problems, which in turn, Ben, just ups the ante because, okay, you just destabilize this population. We'll just use the mountain lions as an example. And so now you're having more livestock killed and you're having mountain lions show up in people's backyards and people say, oh, well, we need to kill even more mountain lions. And, of course, the fish and game agencies and the federal government animal damage control are more than happy to accommodate that. And so we have this never-ending self fulfilling feedback system whereby we kill predators, we disrupt the social relationships, and then that causes more conflicts, which then increases the demands for more control, and we are back to killing more predators more and more of the time. And we've seen this for decades with coyotes, where in particular we've been killing coyotes for 100 years now, with no end in sight, so to speak, because what happens is the coyotes bounce back and we get more calls for predator control, and it just continues.
It seems that I guess part of the underlying theme seems to be that a lot of people in this sort of managerial society somehow believe that they know better how to manage a forest or manage a prairie than the forest or prairie does. And
that, yes, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say one more thing about that, which is there's this great line by David Ehrenfeld, that the world is not only more complex than we think it is, it's more complex than we're capable of thinking.
That is exactly what I would conclude from what I was just saying. And one of the issues or themes that I emphasize all the time is we don't even know the right questions to ask in many cases in order to get the proper answer, because it doesn't even occur to us to ask those questions.
Well, for crying out loud, I recently, after several thousand years of agriculture and deforestation and everything else, scientists have finally realized that the bacterial composition in soil is dramatically different underneath a redwood tree than it is in a meadow 30 feet away. And it seems to me they only just realized this after they're conducting this experiment on a world scale of, you know, dramatically changing entire biomes. And it's just stunning to me. I guess I want to go on about this for a second because, you know, I have Crohn's disease, which is a disease of civilization. As people, as a place industrializes, they get more, Crohn's disease goes up. And there are a bunch of questions as to what the cause is. And one of the very strong theories at this point is that as people industrialize, their hygiene improves. And as their hygiene improves, they have fewer intestinal parasites. And Crohn's is autoimmune. And one of the things that even the FDA says is okay to do, and I actually do it, is to ingest whipworms because they modulate your immune system. And my point is, it strikes me as completely insane to think that you can manage a forest when we don't even know the interactions that happen on, when I walk around without bare feet, I could end up with Crohn's disease. You see what I'm getting at? It's like,
I totally agree. And in fact, you know, getting back to the Ehrenfell quote, or trying to make an analogy to the medical profession, I think our understanding of how ecosystems work is at the same level as when we used to bleed, you know, patients to get rid of their bad blood, assuming that, and in a lot of ways it's sort of analogous to our approach to predators. You go out and you have to bleed the patient to get rid of the bad blood, and if the patient dies, well, it's because you didn't get enough blood out or you didn't kill enough predators. And if the patient survives, well, it's because you bled him, or if the, you know, whatever it is, there's fewer livestock conflicts or there's more elk or whatever, you just attribute it to predators, killing the predators when it may have very little, if nothing, to do with the results you've seen. And So we spend a lot more time trying to understand human medical situation and health, and as you point out, our knowledge there is, you know, still very rudimentary. And you know, ecosystems are and those kind of processes are even more complex, and we spend less time trying to understand them. And I think part of the, you know, this is getting back to the beginning point, and part of the reason we've spent less time trying to understand is because we already think we know everything, or enough anyway to manipulate things on a large scale. And it's always amazed me. I go on field trips with foresters and range guys and others, and they'll tell you all the mistakes they made in the past. A good example in the forest is, it was not uncommon that long ago to pull logs out of streams in the Pacific Coast here, on the thought that you were going to improve salmon and steelhead migrations by getting rid of the obstacles, or what were thought to be obstacles in the stream. And then finally somebody at some point said, well, I wonder what benefit or what role in the ecosystem those logs in the stream play. And when they started looking into that, they found, well, you know, the logs slow down the current, which reduces erosion. It creates habitat for insects that fish feed upon. It provides resting areas because of the slower velocity behind them for migrating fish like salmon and so forth. And now, in some places, the Forest Service is cutting down trees and dragging them to the streams to put them back in. And so the point of that being that we tend to, you know, I'll have foresters admit that that's was a mistake in the past, but now they'll tell me, but we now know enough that we can do all this other manipulation because we now understand it completely. There's no humility or understanding or learning from the past mistakes that perhaps we ought to go forward with real care and constantly questioning our assumptions. And I just don't see enough of that, in particularly in the mindset that thinks that we need to manage the entire planet.
Actually, I want to read you something from that I just wrote in my new book. It's about human supremacism, and I have to find it real quick. It's just because this whole management notion just bothers me so much. Oh, here it is. If a doctor killed or injured every single patient he saw, would you trust your life to this doctor? If a cop bungled every single case she handled, would you want her investigating the death of your loved one? If every single bridge built by a certain engineer collapsed, would you want him building bridges over which you and those you love would travel? If a financial advisor gave you bad advice every single time she opened her mouth, would you trust her with your financial future? And unfortunately, this is really the track record for managers. I asked Tom Butler this question a few weeks ago, and are there any landscapes that human supremacists, so I mean, I'm not talking about indigenous people living long term with their land. I'm not calling that management, okay? Are there any landscapes that have been managed, especially for extraction, that have not been seriously harmed by the management process?
Well, you know, just off the top of my head, my answer would be no. As somebody who's always a little cautious, somebody
yeah, yeah,
might
yeah.
think of some examples. But in general, as a general, especially getting to your point about doing things for commercial profit, that very much skews what happens. Like what I tell people, so, you know, I'm very skeptical of forestry, for example, and foresters' ability to extract wood from the forest. I'm not sure that we can extract any wood on a commercial, and maybe never, not even on a non-commercial, but certainly at the level that makes economic sense to take wood out of the forest. I really wonder if that's too much wood to be taking away. Because wood is very important to the forest ecosystem in a whole lot of ways. So.
I love this line by John Livingston, there is no surplus in nature. I mean, anything you take out of the natural community is you're taking away someone's food or someone's home. And
So
it seems to me, and this is not just true, I believe, with wood. I believe it's true for salmon, that you can take salmon out of the stream and basically you've got to poop them, you know, within 20 miles of the streamers within that biotic community, because that's food for that community.
Exactly. I raised that whole issue about salmon about 20 years ago, wondering if commercial salmon, you know, there was such a thing as a sustainable commercial salmon fishery for exactly that reason, because, you know, the salmon come out of the ocean, they transport nutrients upstream into places that are usually nutrient poor, where they die. And they, you know, plus providing food all along the way. And then, as you're probably aware of some of that research where they found that, you know, a bear eats a salmon and then poops in the woods, and then the tree takes up those nutrients and becomes part of the forest. So the salmon's body is actually eventually converted into a tree, for example. and it's really pretty cool that those kind of relationships exist. And so, can you take a large amount of that, you know, fish stock away from a stream without, over the long term, impoverishing it? You know, that's a question I would always ask, and I don't necessarily have the answer to it. But the fact is that many people who are involved in managing fisheries, for example, don't really ask that question in the first place, and that's the blindness that we have to a lot of these commercial activities because of our desire to use them and, of course, rationalize the use of those, whatever it is, trees, salmon, you know, elk or whatever. We are reluctant to question whether the use of those things is really can be sustained long term. When I find a lot of when people talk about sustainability, they're talking about, for example, I'll use forestry as an example. They're talking about having a sustainable amount of wood for the mill and for providing for the local economy, not necessarily ecological sustainability of what is good for the forest ecosystem over the long term. And that, you know, we can, you know, bring it back to predators and wildlife management. It's the same thing. What is good for the long term in terms of ecosystems of having, the animals that would be there as dictated by natural processes. When we distort those numbers one way or another, whether we're killing predators or trying to have more white-tailed deer, in either case, we're deviating from what would likely be there otherwise, and few people bother to ask, well, what are the consequences of that?
So I want to go back to the question. I sort of asked the question, didn't really give you the opportunity to answer, that who can better manage a forest or especially industrial humans?
Well, you're asking somebody who's biased, but I definitely think that my metrics or what I go by is, you know, is that the forest, to answer your question, is if we're going to anthropomorphize, knows better than we can what is appropriate, and that's why when you know some of these people taking it back to predators say, well, you know, we can have 20 wolves here and that's fine, and my response is, well, maybe naturally there'd be 50 wolves there. So how do you know that, you know, that isn't the right number? How do you know what is the right number? I don't think you can know that. So what I trust is if there's 50 wolves, that's the right number. If there's 10 wolves, that's the right number. But as long as we're not interfering in how that number comes about. And I assume that at times there will be more wolves, every time there will be less wolves, and there will be more elk and less elk and so forth. And we strive, and this is probably, you know, part of our whole genetic code, we strive for safety and security. And so we want predictability. I mean, that's probably, you know, something that comes from a long, long time ago. So we want to know that there's going to be, you know, 100,000 elk in a certain state or something like that. And the Fish and Game Department wants to know there's going to be 100,000 elk. And so it strives to keep it at this number of animals that it thinks is the ideal. And yet what you see oftentimes in nature is that there's a lot of fluctuation and different events will change, you know, for using elk as an example, will change the number of elk and change the relationship of wolves and mountain lion to the elk and so forth. And I don't think it's proper to try to second guess all that.
I think I was interviewing Thomas Berry 20 years ago or so, and I was saying something about how I thought the world should be, you know, wasn't the world in a state of dynamic equilibrium or something? And, you know, just that would be what a forest is. And he said, no, he didn't think so. He thought it was sort of a creative disequilibrium. And the reason I say that is because I think I think that you and he are using different language to say much the same thing, that you can have an elk population explosion and then it'll go down. And it's always in this state of flux sort of around some central point of I don't know what word to use, of something that works for the forest or for the plains or for the prairie or whatever it is. And it comes – go ahead.
Well, I was just going to respond. I think, yes, I largely agree with that concept that these things change in that and often in unpredictable ways and our best thing is to try to learn what we can from it, but not try to substantially change it. And it may be that, you know, using, you know, the example of elk, it may be that elk will go extinct locally or over a region over time, and maybe that's the proper thing. I certainly, as long as it isn't due to something like we're poisoning the soil or something that contributes to that, I would say, well, that's probably okay. I can live with it.
So You mentioned just in passing that that we as a people see predators as competitors, I believe was the word you used. And it seems to me, and we can disagree on this, it seems to me that the hatred of predators is deeper than simply economic competitors. There's this level of viciousness, I think, that with which, or I'm just going to say hatred. It seems to me that there is a hatred of a lot of predators that goes beyond mere sort of implacable economic thought. And I'm wondering, I'm thinking of something that I remember reading a long time ago, that when the Europeans arrived in this continent, that soon after they got here, one of the things that there was a group of Indian nations in the Northeast who got together to talk about this because they couldn't figure out why the white people were killing all the wolves. And they basically thought about it and talked about it over a certain length of time. And by the end of their time together, they basically all they could come up with is they think that the white people were crazy. And
Well,
I
yeah,
want
go ahead.
to. So what is? It seems to me that there is this sort of, which I don't believe is evolutionary. I don't believe that all. I mean, for crying out loud, prior to conquest, along rivers in California, you would see a grizzly bear every 15 minutes. So obviously, the Tolowa, who lived here for 12,500 years, were not wiping out the grizzly bears. So I don't think it's that we're primates who are scared of them. But it seems to me that there is this real thing against predators.
Well, let me respond two things. I'll tell you one little fact that's sort of an antidote to what you started to say about the settlers. And one of the first things that was done in the Massachusetts Bay Colony was a bounty back in 1630. So we're talking real early. You know, the Pilgrims got there in 1620. One of the first things they did was put a bounty on wolves and Indians. So we're seen as being the same, you know, in the same light as problematic, so to speak. And so that's a that sort of substantiates, you know, your point about very early on the settlers and colonists were trying to get rid of predators. And you know, it seems like I'll go a little not directly answer your question, but I do want to take a stab because you made me think of this at explaining one of the issues going on today, which is the predators, particularly the wolf, have come to symbolize to many people in this country a bigger issue. In other words, it's not just that the economic issue that wolves may eat elk or eat my sheep or cows. It is that the wolves are put into as a symbol of federal government in rural, particularly in the rural West, and even more so of more recently the influence of you know, the Obama administration in the view of rural Westerners trying to, quote, shove wolves down our throats. So what happens is that the reaction to wolves gets wrapped up in all these other things, gun control. You know, you're putting wolves out there so you can come and take our guns away. You know, those are the kinds of analogies that are drawn, and I'm not exaggerating at all. And there are, you know, there's a, you know, there's even perhaps a little bit of racism involved. There was a picture that was on the internet last year of some hunters dressed up in white hoods. With the dead wolf in Jackson, Wyoming, that they put on their website, and proud that they killed this wolf, and they're all wearing white hoods. And you know, it doesn't take too much of a jump and leap in imagination that we see the Ku Klux Klan there, and that the wolf is, you know, the new black man of the neighborhood that they're trying to get rid of. And so you know, to get to your point, there's a visceral thing that's going on, reaction that probably all along, but certainly in modern times, these predators have come to symbolize larger issues of that where people are afraid and of various things, whatever it is, and they can't control these things. So they really don't feel like they have control over the federal government. They don't, you know, they see the demographics of the United States changing. They don't have any control over that. But they feel like they can control at least wolves or mountain lions or whatever by, you know, killing and trapping them and so forth. And so it gives them a sense of security in a world where they feel insecure to be able to, you know, have this control over an animal. And I think that that is one of the reasons why you get this visceral reaction that doesn't even make sense. You know, in other words, I'll use one example in Montana, which I'm real familiar with. You will read all the time letters to the editor. You'll see things from the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation and other hunter organizations saying that wolves are decimating the elk herd. And yet, since wolves have been reintroduced into a lot of Montana, there's actually almost double the number of elk today as there was before there were wolves. And so clearly, wolves are not decimating hunting opportunity or the elk herds. But that hasn't stopped groups like the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation and many anti-wolf advocates from asserting that. So, and you can say, well, you know, go to the Montana Fish and Game Department, which is not pro-wolf, by the way, but look at their numbers. You know, they have it there in black and white. And then the reaction, of course, is that that's a conspiracy, because secretly the Montana Fish and Game Department actually wants wolves too. So even if you present facts that are, you know, I mean, the numbers are so large as to be indisputable. I mean, we can argue that maybe there's 140,000 elk as opposed to 150,000 elk in Montana today, whatever. But the point is, there's way more elk than there was before there were wolves. And yet that reality is not acknowledged by those who are against having predators on the landscape. And I think, again, because the predators are symbolic of something more than merely animals that might compete with them for, you know, the ability to kill an elk or protect their livestock. And it's symbolic of something much larger. And I would say for wolf advocates, too, you know, sort of turn it around, there is a lot of symbolism on the other side as well. A lot of the people that are wolf advocates feel, and I would put myself in this category, feel that restoring wolves is a way to make amends for all the damage that we've done to the planet, and that it's a process of healing. And by so wolf restoration becomes symbolic of an attempt to heal the wounds that we've created by our actions in the past. So we're more passionate about, you know, having wolves back on the landscape than merely just saying, oh, we, you know, I can, as I did at the beginning, I can give you all these sort of reasons why I think there's good ecological reasons for having predators. But that isn't really the main reason why I am a wolf advocate. I'm an advocate because I see it as symbolic of a larger acknowledgement of past, and not to get, you know, preachy about it, but past sins, you might say, that we've made to the land. And this is a way to symbolize and acknowledge that we would like to try to heal our relationship to the land. And by restoring predators and accepting predators and learning to live with predators, it teaches us how to better live on the planet as a whole. And if we can learn to live with predators and accept predators, we are then going to be in a better position for healing what we've done to the planet overall in many other ways. And maybe, you know, it isn't nearly as easy as just having some wolves come back. But since a lot of the things that we've done are the result of the way we think and the way that we act, if we can change our thinking and our behavior, then we have a better chance of ultimately living in a more sane relationship with all the life around us.
So I think that that's really brilliant, and I think that the, everything you've said has been really great, and we're pretty much out of time. So I guess I want to ask one quick question, which is, so one of the reasons I do these programs is to not merely change people's thinking, but to change their actions. And so if somebody listens to this, what do you want them to do in terms of specifically having to do with predator advocacy?
I think that the thing that we need to do is change the politics around predator management and take it away from fishing departments who have a bias to kill predators and to demand that that we have our wildlife is allowed to operate and function at the ecosystem level, and that we change our whole premise that we that for example elk and deer are there merely for us to kill for our own use, but that we realize that the predators are very important for and the way we treat predators is very important for our whole relationship to the planet.
Okay, and now even though I said that, I have one more real quick question, which is they make you predator czar tomorrow, and you can actually do policy. What do you do? Do you simply stop wildlife services from killing them, or do you do more proactive stuff too?
Well, I think you know that I think the wolves or cougar and all that are in most cases are perfectly able to be on their own. I might be an advocate of reintroducing them in places where they've been eliminated a long time ago, where they're not likely to get to anytime soon, like the East Coast. But in general, just leaving them alone is the main thing. No longer have a war upon predators, and they'll probably do fine.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been George Werthner. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.